Chapter 3. 2 days into his captivity, the doctor came up with an almost certainly infallible escape plan. He had only to wait until the scout ship, which had been dispatched to repatriate the giant cephalopod, returned in order to act on his ideas. By leaving the palace and boarding the scout ship, the doctor planned to trigger his slave cuff's perimeter violation response. He could use the resulting shock to short out the ship's isometric controls. The pain would probably knock him out, but only for a short duration. Then he could abscond with the ship and seek out his TARDIS. Of course, in order to get anywhere near the ship, he'd have to get past the Master's obscenely good security forces, which might prove more difficult even than it looked, but the Doctor was confident he could manage. After all, he'd previously escaped from Alcatraz, the terrible prison world of Fluke, and even his great-aunt Fiona's interminable slideshow of holiday photos from her trip to Wells. He had until the end of the fortnight when the ship was expected back to learn what he could about the layout and arrangements of the palace complex. A second problem troubled the Doctor still more deeply, however. He suspected the Master knew more than he claimed to about the whereabouts of the Doctor's TARDIS. The Master might even have the ship hidden away somewhere near at hand. If that was the case, the wisest course of action would be to stay and ingratiate himself into the Master's good graces, to wait for the other Time Lord to grow careless and say something revealing, and to search the TARDIS out himself here within the confines of the palace. Still, he could be wrong, and meanwhile the Doctor felt he had to try and escape. The mere thought of belonging to the Master made him squirm, agitated him more even than such an abysmal situation seemed to merit. Not that the Master hadn't been cordial these last past weeks. Far from it. He had conducted himself according to impeccable standards. He hardly seemed the Doctor's slave master, more a gracious host, almost a dear friend of long standing. The Master had invited the Doctor to take almost every meal in his company. He frequently fetched the Doctor out of the lab, asking for assistance on whatever project he was personally attending to at the time. The Doctor hardly minded. While he didn't feel himself intellectually outdone by the Master, he privately admitted to relishing the pleasures of collaboration, to luxuriating in the Master's praise and appreciation, all the more valuable because it came from that particular source. The Doctor had only to mention that a certain book or bit of equipment would be useful in his work, and the Master had it delivered to him. In the morning, the Doctor would come into the lab, slipping a white lab coat over his cream jacket and wondering whether it was an Earl Grey or an English breakfast sort of morning. He turned to his desk only to find a helmet regulator or what have you sitting boldly on his chair, accompanied by a note from his purchaser, as if it were a present. The other scientist's envious, appreciative responses told the Doctor the Master wasn't always so obliging about supply requisitions. Naturally, the Master had an unbelievable amount of money to spend as he liked and excellent connections to exploit. But even if such a gift were easy for him to give, the Doctor, who had forged all his life to obtain decent equipment without drawing the attention of the CIA, appreciated receiving it. Appreciated being so considered. However greatly he detested being owned in principle, at times, especially in the other man's presence, the Doctor forgot to feel the indignity of being nominally forced to do the Master's bidding. When he brooded on his situation at each day's end, struggling to fall asleep in the uncomfortable collar and cuffs, he cursed himself for his complicity. Once, as a youth, the Doctor had managed to get himself lost without a map in 19th century Constantinople. It had been one of his first excursions in time before he had learned to pilot the TARDIS properly, or even to use her telepathic language circuits. He found himself adrift, buffeted by the unintelligible, insistent caress of foreign words, tracing uncertain paths through blind alleys and thick crowned swoops, bewildered by a thousand novel, intoxicating sensations, by the bazaars full of colour and sound, by the gardens with their thousand commingled scents, by the city itself with its million souls and its 10 million soft, dark mysteries. He had just such a sense of being overwhelmed in the Master's company. The man's mind was unlike any the Doctor had known, Byzantine and rich. Working with him was baffling and rewarding, as challenging and seductive as losing himself in the strange labyrinthine heart of that ancient city had been. Of course, the Master represented a fresh opportunity for the Doctor to learn more about his father's people. But more than that, he was charming and witty, well-travelled and even better informed. The Doctor, never forgetting what the Emperor was, enjoyed his company. He wished they might have met in different, less adversarial circumstances. They were of an age. They might even have been boyhood friends had the Doctor been reared on Gallifrey. But as things stood, there was no help for it. The Doctor knew very well he had to leave at the first opportunity. The lookout attacked 18 hours before the scout ship was due to arrive back at the palace. The primary lights cut out without warning. A scientist across the lab cursed in frustration. His delicate experiment had been ruined by the sudden deprivation of power. Red secondary lights flickered once, twice, and then they came and stayed on. A low klaxon wound down the corridor outside the lab door, and a frazzled Professor Linley came out of his private office carrying a communicator that was crackling with radio chatter. Troop movements, from what the Doctor could make out. "Everyone in!" Linley started waving the confused scientists into a back room that normally served as a botanical sample storage bay. The Doctor suddenly realised that someone, probably the Master, had been incredibly clever and had decided to shore up the facility for use as an emergency shelter. The scientists could be trapped in the greenhouse for days and still have adequate supplies of oxygen, food and water. Whatever his moral character, the master was a truly remarkable man. Curious about what was going on, and hardly adverse to interfering if he didn't like it, the doctor wandered towards the hall door instead. Doctor! The May called from the door of the bunker. Stop dawdling! My standing orders are to seal the room with all civilian scientific personnel inside. I'm just going to pop out and have a look around, Professor. Go ahead and seal the door. I think I can manage. How? You're a non-combatant! The May sputtered. And his finger besides. He'll have my head if any harm comes to you. Irked at being treated as though he were the master's beloved pet, the doctor scanned the hall up and down before stepping out into it. If I see the master, I'll let him know you put up a valiant struggle, but sadly, I managed to eventually overpower you. I won't be long. See you on the other side. Doctor! May pulled at his white hair in frustration. What am I going to tell him? What am I going to do? Well, the doctor said brightly, craning his neck to judge whether he could detect any sounds of action from either direction. You might smoke me a kipper. What? Oh, never mind, Professor. I'll explain later. The doctor took a coin from his pocket and flipped it. He examined the result with a frown, and then discreetly turned it the other side up on his palm. He slipped it back into his pocket with a satisfied nod. This way, I think. And the doctor started down the corridor whistling. Remembering, oh dear, oh dear, oh dear. Under his breath and shaking his head, Lin May slid the door home and punched in his security code. The doctor stopped whistling when he smelled something burning. He peered around a corner carefully, but could see only wisps of smoke in the hallway. Sparks spurted from a few dozen broken wall panels. The doctor threaded his way through the jagged shards of components that coated the floor, moving towards the throne room and control center. He was careful to keep far away from the sizzling exposed connections as possible. He stopped dead when he heard the distinctive click whir of a laser rifle being cocked. He held up his hands to show he carried no weapons. Ah, hello. I was wondering if perhaps you could explain what's going on here. Doctor? The master emerged from behind a structural column, turning back to address his troops. Stand down, gentlemen. He's one of ours. Doctor, what exactly are you doing here? You should be safely out of the way. I've told Lin May to secure his people in the event of a situation. The doctor lowered his hands and shoved them into his coat pockets, raising an eyebrow. I'm afraid I insisted on having my own way. And you might not credit it, but I assure you I am capable of looking after myself. Really? The master sneered. I suppose I must then have been hallucinating only a moment ago when you walked utterly defenceless into a corridor thickly blanketed with smoke, directly into the firing range of my guards. The doctor arched an eyebrow. And yet I'm perfectly fine, as you see. The master registered surprise, then laughed. My dear doctor, your survival is a matter of purest luck. Something I include in all my plans. It's never yet failed me. The doctor considered that statement for a moment. Well, hardly ever. This is, well, my element, my raison d'etre, interfering in crises, repelling invasions, fermenting rebellions, averting disasters, rescuing the odd kitten from a particularly daunting tree. You should really run background checks on the people you enslave. It had saved me a great deal of embarrassing self-promotion. What I mean to say is this is hardly the first or even the most impressive occasion on which I've been under fire, and if you can tell me exactly what it is you're up against, I may be able to help you. The doctor paused a moment and then remembered to smile. Please. The master studied his face. You know, Doctor, I do believe you're telling the truth. Well, I admit I was having you on about the kittens. They tend to rescue themselves. The master's lip quirked. He studied the doctor as if weighing him, and with a sharp nod came to his decision. We're being assaulted by Likart dervishes. Have you heard of them? He began walking, his guards following and the doctor keeping in step with him. Likart, the doctor frowned, trying to place the name. I don't know that I have. It's an extreme religious cult, one which has recently attempted to make inroads in the Heston system. I normally pay religious crazes as little attention as they deserve, but the Likart are an unusual breed. Their order advocates absolute dedication to simplicity. As in clean living, lots of hearty gruel and single-fibre clothing? The doctor asked, wondering as he did so what was so fearsome about the space Amish, and indeed how they could even be said to attack. Perhaps they'd come by offering pamphlets and homemade pies, and the master detested door-to-door proselytizers. The master chuckled. I'm afraid the Likart definition of simplicity is more elemental in nature. Their eventual goal is to reduce all complex matter to its unspoiled original conditions, for all living creatures to return from the primordial soup from whence they came. They believe that once they've eradicated all traces of higher order, life will be reborn in a purer form. Ah. The doctor frowned. I take it they don't ask politely before reducing people to their component parts. You guessed correctly. Their berserker troops have a particularly fearsome reputation. In the service of their faith, they ingest a unique cocktail of chemicals. The draft breaks down all higher brain function. It also destroys the berserker's capacity to process pain at a neurological level. They suffer from an inconsolable rage, a cureless madness. They destroy everything in their path without ever succumbing to fatigue or pain, including each other should they get too close. At the end of an engagement, their priestly masters come along to retrieve the survivors and convey them to their next target. That sounds terribly inconvenient for everyone involved, the doctor said. Except possibly the priests. One might put it that way, Doctor. It's particularly tiresome for those of us trying to run an empire in an orderly fashion. The Dervish legions have as yet been merely a local nuisance. My intelligence network leads me to believe they recently succeeded in waylaying a Morvellan convoy after it had been weakened in conflict with the Daleks. The Lickout have thus acquired better transport and weaponry than they've ever previously have access to. They could easily become a universal threat, though at present I find myself infinitely more concerned by the threat they represent to my palace. The Doctor frowned, disturbed by the prospect. The Master's well-defended empire aside, this region of the galaxy had already been deeply unsettled by the long war between the Morvellans and the Daleks, who had yet to enter the two-century-long stalemate he himself had helped bring to an end in the relative future. The Lickout might well take advantage of conditions such as desperation and despair to indoctrinate a steady stream of converts. Whatever qualms the Doctor might have about the Master's appropriation of power, his regime was certainly superior to anarchic chaos, and his administration was more legitimate than a predatory nihilistic theocracy. "Where are we headed?" the Doctor asked, having privately invited himself along. The Master raised an eyebrow. "My guards and I are investigating reports of intrusion in the South Corridor. Some of the Lickout have already come through here, as you can see by the damage, but I have dispatched the entirety of the advance force. All my guard stations have been mobilized, troops are being held in reserve at various points en route to the control center. If the front line should be forced to retreat, they'll have cover and reinforcements standing ready to receive them." The Doctor stopped and leveled a severe look at the Master, forcing the other man to stop as well. "It's hardly necessary for the Emperor himself to lead the squadron most likely to see combat. Why aren't you sheltered in the control center? You'd hardly be the first ruler to get himself killed by insisting on riding out with the front line. Why aren't you in the emergency shelter?" The Doctor hadn't considered it quite like that. He grinned quick and bright. "Touché, shall we? What makes you think I'm not sending you right back in the direction you came now that I've sated your insufferable curiosity?" the Master asked, but he sounded more amused than annoyed. "I'm afraid I'm not entirely satisfied. Yet." The Doctor clasped his hands behind his back. "Besides, I'd only ignore you if you tried, and you're far too busy to punish me for insubordination at the moment." The Master's look soured. "Doctor, when I give you an order, I will circumvent, willfully misinterpret, and generally disregard it to the best of my ability. You'll find you get along much better with requests. Now, I believe we were headed in the direction of the bottleneck." The Doctor started walking, this time forcing the Master to keep pace with him. The Master's guards followed along behind in a string like baby ducklings after their mother. The Doctor turned and walked backwards, hands clasped behind his back. "I've only just noticed these corridors are wide enough to march troops through. That's almost unheard of in a palace this age. I assume you did a bit of housemanism when you took over the palace." The Master looked at him blankly, and the Doctor, not for the first time, lamented how few people properly appreciated human cultural references. "Houseman," the Doctor explained, "was an architect who redesigned the medieval city of Paris at the behest of the King of France. He destroyed the city's close, crowded buildings and alleys in favour of wide boulevards on a geometric plan. Of course, this allowed troops and artillery to move around the city with all the ease of blood flowing through arteries. The development scheme was aimed at facilitating military policing as much as it was at modernising and beautifying the capital." "How interesting." The Master grabbed the Doctor by his elbow, steering him around the live wire he'd come close to stepping on while speaking. "And yes, I suppose I do. Well observed, Doctor. When I came into possession of it, the palace was..." He stopped and held up his hand, indicating the troops should halt as well. "Can you hear that?" he murmured to the Doctor. As the Doctor was shaking his head, a sliver of sound reached him and he stopped. It came strange and sharp, like something hard on metal, but without the resonant clang scrape of steel on steel. The Master, with feline stealth, crept to the intersection where the passageway met another. He peered around the corner. Without looking back, he motioned for the Doctor to join him. Pressing close to the shorter man in order to see, the Doctor looked. Three women and a man, far down the corridor, energetically thrashing at the walls with blades that resembled long, white reaping sickles. "That explains the damage to the panelling," the Doctor observed, then frowned. "What are those things they're wielding?" "Bones," the Master said curtly. "They're victims, each other's. The Lickout aren't overly scrupulous about the source. They rend whatever they kill, harvest the meat for food or sacrifices, and use the bones for cudgels, as you see. They prefer to use the sharpened pelvises as an axe shaft, using the attached bones of the leg as the handle. The priests pour resin over the joints to set them and preserve the bones. The edge wears off quickly, but there's always a fresh source of materials near at hand, and the psychological advances of the weapon that confer on the lookout is far from insignificant. One of the lookouts swung in their direction as if she'd heard a noise. She staggered a few steps forward, listening intently. The master drew a thin, elegant laser pistol from her holster at his waist and tried to press it into the doctor's hands. "Take it," he hissed when the doctor wouldn't close his fingers around the hilt. "I prefer not to carry guns," the doctor shoved it back towards him. "And I prefer you alive, doctor." The master, though he hadn't taken his eyes off the party of lookout, was clearly growing irritated. "The lookout aren't interested in your sensibilities and won't hesitate to rip you to shreds." "And it sounds as though we're going to need a better plan than take pot shots at the few of them we can see with a laser pistol." The doctor stepped back, and grudgingly the master withdrew his blaster. "How many do you think there are?" The doctor leaned down to whisper into the master's ear, heedless of how distracting that was. The master, not turning, spoke in a low voice. "It's impossible to be sure. We had disabled the security systems with an EMP. We must have noticed when the lights cut out and we had to switch over to backup generators. Ours is the only squadron to have reported any visual contact thus far. There's a grate nearby that the kitchens use to draw up water from the system. The previous residents called the well the Shrunken Palace. It extends for miles, supported by a forest of marble columns. I've had it sealed and secured naturally, but provided the lookout were taking appropriate advantage of their recently acquired Mavellan equipment, the EMP pulse they used could have allowed them to break through the locks. If the lookout came through the system, as I believe they did, by now they could have landed dozens of their dervishes directly below the palace." The doctor winced at the grating sound of humanoid bone hacking relentlessly at the wall. "We'll have to get past these four to investigate, I suppose." The master smiled, taking something from his jacket pocket. "I'm afraid so, Doctor. Of course," he gestured towards the lab with his blaster, "if you'd rather turn back, you are, as I believe I made inescapably clear, more than welcome to." The doctor glared at him, but otherwise ignored the dig. The master toyed with a spear in his hand. A green light came on, and the master, stepping out into the hallway, cleared his throat and grinned, glancing over to make sure his audience was watching. "Now, Doctor, please attend carefully." With a sudden scream, the lookout at the end of the hall rushed towards their prey, and the master deftly bowled the ball. It came to a stop in the dead centre of the path, about 10 meters in front of their advancing party. The orb shot out gas, and as they pushed past the wavering purple streams, got in their hair, their mouth, their nostrils. The lookout began to move more slowly, to stumble and then to drop. They struggled on, one falling to his knees, only a metre away from the master, still clawing at the calm, unmoving emperor, managing almost to touch his boot. They convulsed and then they lay still. "A nerve gas of my own design," the master explained to the doctor, who'd stepped out into the hall to observe the prone lookout himself. "The effect is temporary, but they'll be comatose for no fewer than 48 hours. He glanced back over his shoulder. "Any time, the rest of you?" With an air of sheepishness, the master's guards followed the more intrepid doctor out into the hall. The doctor had bent down to examine the lookout. His hands hovered over one of the women's faces, but hesitant, he glanced up at the master. "How is the toxin the priests use on them transmitted?" The master knelt down beside him. "Ingestion, not via the skin. She should be perfectly safe to touch." The master watched the doctor's long, pale fingers gently tilt the woman's head up. He closed her blank, staring eyes. The master couldn't exactly explain away the stab, the clutch of desire he felt, watching the almost avian arc of the doctor's hands, the spread of his fingers elegant as a wingspan, as he lowered her head to the floor and took a sample collected from his jacket. Flicking the cap off, the doctor jabbed the end of the collector into her arm, and the sample cavity blossomed red. "I'd like a better look at their neurotoxin," the doctor offered by way of explanation. "An excellent notion." The master stood, straightened, and helped the doctor to his feet. He swallowed as the hands he'd admired curled and tightened around his gloved ones before the other man pulled back. "This way." A few turns brought them to the grating, or where the grating had been. The metal cut through lay in jagged pieces on the floor. The master motioned to one of the guards, who shot a powerful light down the stairs that descended from the former grating into the system. The sweep of it revealed nothing and no one, and the master could hear nothing but the deep cave drip of the water below them and the doctor's breath at his side. "Could you throw another one of your gas bombs down?" the doctor suggested. The master shook his head. "Our options are more limited than that. The stairs descend deep into the bedrock, and the chambers below are far too extensive for a gas bomb to be of any use. It would be like dropping a drop of poison into the bathwater of someone you'd like to assassinate." The master gestured one of the guards forward, and when the man called back the all clear, he climbed through, dusting off his jacket fastidiously as the doctor clambered in after him. They started down the stairs, both preceded and followed by the guards. Are these for the news? The doctor asked, staring up in wonder at the high ceilings, the elaborate carvings on the wall. Certainly. The master scanned the way in front of them with a beam of his torch, wary and tense. The ancient Hestinians were remarkable engineers. Their systems are still largely functional, and there's an undeniable elegance even in their most utilitarian public works. The staterooms are uniformly exquisite. The master cleared his throat and then offered casually, I would be delighted to give you a proper tour of the palace, Doctor, if you would be interested. The doctor watched his hand. He held it out, tracing the carvings along the wall as their party descended. He smiled, though only the boar could appreciate the gesture. I should like that, thank you. Unobserved by the Time Lords, one of the rear guards silently elbowed his compatriot in the ribs. The poked guard rolled his eyes, sighed, and internally reconciled himself to being 20 credits shorter. At the bottom of the stairs, they found themselves in an antechamber to the system. The system turned out to be a vast room that stretched on for so long it was hard to make out the other side. The doctor, looking up, observed a vast rusted portcullis drawn up through the stone above them. The master caught the direction of his gaze and had opened his mouth to offer a comment when he heard a small splash. His head whipped in the direction it had come from, and he brought the torch to bear. Nothing. With narrowed eyes, he aimed it further back into the gloom. At first, it looked like nothing still, but then the master made out near a pillar in the middle of the room a flicker of movement, a humanoid figure, and another. As he slowly panned the light around the room, his eyes grew wider. A few dozen troops, the doctor parroted him in a tight, quiet voice. I'd estimate more like a few thousand. Yes, thank you, Doctor, the master hissed back. I had noticed. Towards the back they were thicker crammed, but none of the lookout had moved any further towards the stairs than the centre of the room. They hadn't rushed the palace itself on their own bloodthirsty initiative. What are they waiting for? The doctor murmured. Surely not holding off until the moment of greatest strategic advantage. They don't seem capable. I suspect their handlers have trained them to respond to some form of attack command, the master mused. Perhaps a particular sound, or his torch beam attracted the attention of one of the lookout trudging in the room's centre. The grime-smeared wild man let out a low, grotesque moan that swelled, becoming a shriek that echoed in the cavern vastness. Other lookout took up the cry, and they began to surge across the shallow water towards the stairs at astonishing speed. All the light, the doctor finished for him. Come on, the master growled, tugging the doctor along. Back up the stairs now! The doctor, looking back to gauge their process, resisted. Do you see how fast they're moving? We'll never make it to the top in time. And even then, how are we to stop them from... We suddenly don't have any hope of outrunning them if you don't come now, doctor, the master hissed through his teeth. His troops were already a few steps up, obviously itching to run. Only their loyalty to the master had kept them from fleeing already. Give me one of your bombs, the doctor held out his hand. What? There isn't time to explain. There's only enough poison in them for a score of people, and even if a few still bodies clog the doorway, the lookout will simply rip through them and keep coming. Master, just trust me, please. With a furious expression, the master shoved a bomb into the doctor's open palm. The lookout was streaming into the antechamber. The doctor took a step back and aimed, light reflecting off his wrist cuff as he wound up and let fly. The heavy ball hit the wheel that controlled the portcullis's counterweights, and with enough force to set it turning, then spinning, and then the gate slammed down in front of the lookout. The berserkers toppled into each other, shoving their limbs through the lattice, writhing in uncomprehending, desperate fury. A perfect spin ball, the doctor announced contentedly to no one in particular. If I do say so myself. I might even go so far as to call it a Jafar. He glanced over his shoulder to the master. You did only just tell me their technology was largely still in good working order. Your kitchens draw water from the system. I took a chance this was one of those devices that was still operational. My dear doctor, the master couldn't restrain a delighted laugh. You are incomparable. The doctor observed the master's high colour, his Cheshire grin. You know, I think you're enjoying this far too much. The master took a step closer, chuckling. And I suppose you aren't. No, you admitted as much yourself, Doctor. This is your element. The master turned back to his guards. Come along. He took the stairs briskly, commenting to the doctor as he went. I want to reinforce the portcullis with a force field. It was hardly built to take the strain of thousands of mindless zombies crushed up against it. Back in his private laboratory, the master established his force field, and then, as the doctor had feared he would, asked for the blood sample he'd collected. The doctor took it from his coat pocket, but held on to it, pulling back slowly when the master reached for it, as if he were a little boy in the playground who didn't want to share. What exactly do you intend to do with this? I will take care of the lookout problem permanently, Doctor, which killing a few thousand foot soldiers, if that's what you're afraid I'll do, could never hope to achieve. I deplore such unsophisticated solutions. Now the vial, if you please. The master made an impatient gesture, and reluctantly the doctor held it out to him. Excellent, the master said, plucking it from the doctor's fingers. You've made the correct choice. I hope I have. The doctor fixed him with a steady, unyielding look. I can do this, you know. Surely it's my job. Surely it's my palace, the master parried. I'm thus entitled to do as I choose within its confines. No, doctor. He swirled the sample, holding it up to the light to better gauge its colour and viscosity. A slow smile spread across his face. You shall have to wait. I know exactly what I'm going to do. The doctor released his co-workers, none of whom were comfortable with the seething army of raging maniacs trapped beneath them, with nothing better to do than stew and occasionally eat each other. The scientists weren't much better off. Still running on emergency power, they had nothing better to do than stew and occasionally eat each other's biscuits. For 4 hours, the doctor helped the neighbouring biologist work through his stash of caramel chocolate wafers, stopping only when the master entered the main laboratory, heading straight for the doctor's desk. The doctor opened his mouth, but the master interrupted him. Watch, doctor. He gestured the doctor to a chair and flipped on a camera feed. It displayed footage of the system. The master paid no attention to the other scientists in the lab, who formed their de facto audience. Any moment, From the manhole covers in the maintenance crawl space over the system, masked servants on the master's instruction dropped small pellets. The objects were small and white, and their descent was almost impossible to track. When they hit, the reaction was remarkable. The water seemed to sizzle, and steams of gas bubbled up and enveloped the panicked lookout. Are you kidding? The doctor whirled on him. Hardly. The master leaned back. I've retro-engineered the berserker neurotoxin. When they wake up, they'll be as capable of higher functioning as ever they were. A group of the lookout wavered and disappeared, and the master's self-satisfied grin widened. We'll teleport on them, the doctor realised. Right back to the ships they came from. The next batch disappeared, and then the next. I found their priests floating above the North Pole, hiding from my scanners in electromagnetic chatter. I don't envy the lookout priests when the dervish is awake. The master chuckled darkly. Perhaps some of the soldiers were true believers, but I suspect many of them were misled or pressed into service. Even those who imagined they knew precisely what they were agreeing to might find their sanity an unwelcome burden after all they've witnessed and done. The doctor watched the slow evacuation of the system. That's terribly cruel to any innocents among them, and even the guilty. Crueler than perpetuating their servitude to the lookout priests trapped by their own hellish madness. Which would you prefer, Doctor? Guilt or that savage, uncomprehending ignorance? There should have been another way, the doctor murmured to himself. But then he shook his head, stood and turned. I don't mean to, that is to say, I'm not unimpressed. You contrived a brilliant solution where you might, with some justification, have resorted to butchery. And you dealt with that group in the corridor remarkably well. Throughout the entire situation, you were pretty sort of... The master raised an eyebrow. Go on. Sort of, yes. Marvellous? The master smiled encouragingly, relishing the moment. Marvellous? Yes, certainly. The doctor cleared his throat and hoped he didn't look flushed. You prevented a great deal of catastrophe today. He shifted his weight, propping himself against the desk. Some of the dervishes might even recover and break the power of the lookout from within. And that was accommodated within the scope of my plan, Doctor. The master gave him an indulgent look, leaning back against the doctor's desk as well, splaying his hand out on its surface. Possibly because I preferred to rely on more solid variables than hope and luck. You were magnificent yourself, the master chuckled. You positively saved me in the system, and with primitive sporting skills. The doctor glared severely at him over his spectacles. I'll have you know that cricket is far from unsophisticated. You even managed to find ball against that advanced pass yourself. You've the potential to be a perfectly adequate linesman, if only you put this empire business in mothballs. With a scoff, the master turned to go, but the doctor cleared his throat. The master turned back. What is it, Doctor? It's just... you're going to have to let go, the doctor pointed out, looking down at his waist, where sure enough the master's treacherous arm had at some point in the conversation come to rest, seemingly of his own volition. His fingers were curled securely around the other Time Lord, and attempting to leave, he'd been half-dragging the doctor along with him. The master let go as abruptly as if he'd been burned, took a step back, gave the doctor an odd seasick look, and swept out of the room with all the dignity he could muster. That evening, the doctor was enjoying a cup of tea, reading in bed, and vaguely contemplating his impending escape. He always enjoyed a bit of downtime after outsmarting Davros or surviving an encounter with hostile aliens or what have you. A mixed stack of Agatha Christie's and P.G. Woodhouse's currently dominated his bedside table. The master had kindly offered to order him whatever books he might require. Heston was, after all, on galactic trade routes, and the doctor had, after making polite protestations, taken liberal advantage of his generosity. The knock on his door surprised him. Yes? He asked cautiously. There's something I must speak with you about. It was unmistakably the master. The doctor supposed the man who owned him didn't technically need to knock at all, much less worry about the unseemliness of the hour. He looked down, checking what he was wearing. Roof charmers, the button tie on the neck, fine, perfectly respectable. He slipped his reading glasses off and sat up at the side of the bed. Come in. The master slipped through, shutting the door behind him. He was holding a device of some sort. "Give me your right hand," he instructed the doctor. The doctor rubbed the cuff there, hesitating. The master raised his eyebrow. "I trusted you today, doctor, with my gun, my explosives, even my life. Surely you could extend me the same courtesy. Now give me your hand." The doctor grudgingly held out both his wrists, compliant and simultaneously contrary. "I intend to release you from these," the master indicated the cuffs, "and give you the run of the palace." He took careful note of the doctor's shock and some stranger emotion, perhaps a trace of quickly hidden disappointment. Put that aside to consider later. "But in order to do that, I require something of you, doctor." The doctor thought of the Earl King, of human fairy tales, of bad bargains foolishly made. His wide eyes turned wary. "What is it you want?" "Simply a word," the master said gentler, "or parole, if you will. You've been good enough to tell me that you plan to escape." He'd seen how very willful and capable the doctor was today, and had already taken steps to increase his security accordingly. "The urge is natural enough, though foolish and regrettable. I could easily keep you chained, but the degree to which your current bondage discomforts you is obvious. I would prefer you," he met the doctor's eyes, "to be comfortable. All I want from the moment is your promise that you won't use this particular display of trust in order to escape me." The doctor was silent, and the straining moment stretched between them long and aching like the stalling trail of light in a parallax which marked the movement of a ship in space just before it bursts into a speed superior even to that of light. "Do I have it?" the master pressed. "Yes," the doctor murmured. "You have my word." There was no way to say no and affect tomorrow's intended escape plan, of which the cuffs were an essential component. To try and say no now would look so suspicious that the master would lock him in his bedroom for the day, citing wretched ingratitude as just cause, if nothing else. "Good." The master, pleased, removed his gloves and leaned over the doctor. He passed his device over first the left cuff and then the right, then covered the doctor's slender wrist with his bare hands. He stroked the metal, letting it detect his bioprint, the doctor realised. The cuff snapped off under his touch, the left falling onto the bed, the right bouncing off the counterpane and clattering to the floor. The master's skin seemed especially dark, curled around the doctor's white wrists, which had hardly seen the sun since he'd regenerated. The master knelt on the bed and the doctor bowed his head. The master's thumb skated over the nape of his neck, rubbing against the downy gold hair that swirled there. "This will only take a moment," the master murmured, holding the collar between his thumb and forefinger. The doctor obligingly bent into his touch, hyper-aware of the other man's proximity. In his bedroom, in his bed, touching him. Drew in a sharp breath when the lock clicked apart under the master's fingers, which seemed to hesitate over his skin a moment too long. "There," the master said, drawing the talk away. "I trust you feel less burdened?" "Infinitely less." The doctor looked at him with sincere gratitude, and the master, returning his gloves to his hands, had to admit to himself that removing the cuffs was not so much a reward for services rendered as a gift, an indulgence. The coy propriety of the bedroom scene made the doctor all the more enticing. A prim blue pyjama top waiting to be unbuttoned, matching captivating blue eyes, waking to darken and flicker shut with desire, skin that glowed warm in the dim light of the reading lamp, waiting to flush under his touch, and wearing socks for Rassilon's sake. The doctor was ridiculous, brilliant, terribly desirable, charming in every particular. Had he ever wanted anyone so fiercely? He could remember no comparable occasion. In fact, in the doctor's presence, it was worryingly difficult to recall any person he previously entertained designs on. The master swallowed. "I'll leave you to your reading. Good night, doctor." He stood to leave, turning towards the door, his back to the bed. "Thank you, master." The doctor's voice stopped him for a moment, and then the master nodded stiffly before leaving. He had, he thought, on the somehow especially long and lonely walk back to his rooms, a very serious problem.